Welcome to International Clearance. Big entrance there at the start. I don't know why I did that. Maybe because
I kind of liked it.
Maybe because we're recording late and I'm thinking, right. Don't be low energy. Don't be low energy. I'm Joe Walker. The other voice you heard was Scully. We co-host this show every week. At least we try to. This is a podcast where we discuss, follow, chronicle, and interview footballers playing or coaching abroad. We had a great guest last week, Thomas Stewart, who's currently managing at Utterhugdal in the Swedish fourth tier. None of you correctly guessed that, though, before the episode came out. We like to post passports on our socials with stamps about where everybody's played or coached abroad as a kind of like clue to who's coming. And we normally big up people who guess correctly, but nobody did.
I'm shocked, actually. I'm shocked.
Well, we've only had very few guests that aren't from England. So Thomas was our first from Northern Ireland. And we've had one Scottish guest as well, Charlie Mitchell. And I think if they're English, people are a lot more familiar with them because of course, Cam's wonderful account, English Players Abroad. I think that does a lot of legwork for people to be familiar with Crazy Odysseys Abroad. And I think maybe Thomas, just being from a different country, might not have come across people's personal databases, you know?
Yeah, fair. So I feel like he played for a couple of teams, but, you know, fair enough. We like to make it difficult. I actually kind of enjoyed that they couldn't get it, so.
Yeah, that shows we're digging a bit deeper. There are stories out there to be told that you don't even know about that we think are interesting, and there's going to be a really big one on today's episode. But before we get into all that, we will quickly run through some events, some stories, some names to highlight and salute, because in the week or so since the last episode, we've had the Champions League, and there are a lot of English players in the Champions League semi-finals now. So you've got Jadon Sancho, Jamie Bynoe-Gittens, both played their part in Dortmund, overcoming Atletico. You've got Eric Dier and Harry Kane seeing out Bayern's aggregate victory over Arsenal.
Yeah.
Man of the match, Eric Dier, I dare say. Who had that in their locker?
No, he was not man of the match. We let him do what he wanted, but I'm not going to give him man of the match. But he did what he had to do, I guess. We just couldn't finish our dinner. But what I will say about Jadon Sancho made me realise football fans are fickle. Football fans always say, you know, I missed a beautiful game. I just want to see wingers not obsessed with stats, just to take people on, have fun, dribble, show a bit of flair. Yeah. You get someone like Jadon Sancho, he comes on, that's all he did in the Atletico Madrid game. He was just spinning guys up for fun. Mm-hmm. And then what did you get? A bunch of football fans come online and say, well, yeah, he might have been doing a bit of flary chicks and that, but where's the end product? Where's the assists? Where are the goals? What do you want, guys? Just enjoy the game.
Well, there are many ways to skin a cat. And if you want to see you want Sancho way, you've got him there in the Champions League semi-finals. If you want the Eric Dier way, they're also in the Champions League semi-finals, so you're very lucky. Kane, by the way, I'll quickly mention, has now hit 14 all competitions this season. He got a free kick over the weekend. Not going to hit Lewandowski's league tally, I think. I'm not really going to break that this time, but 40 all comps in your first season anywhere is pretty good. Pretty good. But yeah, Dier, Kane, Sancho, Bynoe-Gittens, and one other Englishman in the Champions League semi-finals. That man, that young boy even, he's 20 years old, it's Jude Bellingham. Incredible week, actually. Plays his part in beating Man City in the Champions League. Mm-hmm. And then goes to the Bernabeu for El Clasico. They won 3-2 at the Bernabeu, and it was another injury time winner from Jude Bellingham. Lovely little dance around the corner flag, little arm in arm with, I think it was Rodrigo.
No, do you know it was Vasquez?
Dancing around Real Madrid's corner flag with Vasquez. I don't know about you, Scully, when I played football in a garden growing up, mm-hmm. I would play out an entire career in my mind, making an impression at my local club and then taking them up the leagues, mm-hmm. winning these cups, scoring this tense final, and it would be a 3-2. Mm-hmm. It would be an injury time winner.
Yeah.
He's doing that in real life. And he's still a baby boy.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that. I'm like, what more is there? Like he's going to have a great career, a really long, great career, hopefully, God willing, yeah? What do you do at 22 when you, like, have potentially won it all? Like, say Real Madrid going to win this Champions League, yeah? They win the league, yeah? You say they do it again next season, yeah? Because Barca, obviously, Xavi's staying, but they're in a bit of a weird spot. Like, they still don't have a perfect team. Aleko aren't quite there, all of this. Girona's not quite there. So they'll probably do it again. What is it at 22? Like, what is the challenge when you're... Because his prime will still be half a decade away.
Yeah, he's climbed the highest peak and his frontal lobe won't have formed yet.
Yeah, like, mad. Do you look for a next, like, challenge? Like, oh, okay, look at that team, they're shit. I'm going to go and fix them. Like, what do you do?
Well, if it's anything like my adventures in the garden, after the second or third Champions League and you know, Palace are happy where they are, I've set them up quite well.
Yeah.
I shocked the footballing nation by going, I just want to go on loan somewhere. And so I go on loan to Marseille, win Ligue 1, go to AC Milan, win. I just tick off all these leagues
and then come
back when I'm ready. And I think no one could say, he can do that. He can do that.
He actually could do that. Yeah. I don't think he will, but no. I'd love it.
It's happened so much and so quickly for him that he's now stuck to only be able to go to about 5 clubs in the world.
Yeah. The wages, like, that's what I mean. Like, what do you do at 24 if you're bored of La Liga?
What will be interesting, because I think the club game, he's going to achieve whatever he wants.
Mm-hmm.
International game is different. And
it kind of doesn't rely on him. The thing is, England have enough talent, and everyone goes on about how much England has so much talent. But it's down to the FA and the coaches and the managers, and how they build a well-balanced squad that builds the best out of themselves. And like right now, Bellingham is killing it in what I call the false 10. Like, you're a 10, but you're not really a 10. You're actually kind of a 9. Mm. Yeah. It is the Kaká role. People are so shocked when Carlo Ancelotti is like, oh my God, he reminds me of Kaká. People get so offended by that. And it's like, just watch him. That's clearly what he's doing. Obviously, Palmer is having an amazing season. Palmer wants to play. Foden is quality. He's a 10. Like, you can't play all three of them at once. Someone suffers if they go out on the wing. They're all around similar ages. It's all a bit tight. It will be very interesting. I actually think Bellingham could play 8 really well, but then will Rice suffer? Who loses out? Like, we have so many good players at the moment that it is actually quite interesting to see how we're going to balance that. It is basically exactly like when we had Scholes, Gerrard, Lampard at the same time and a bunch of other great players, but that midfield was never quite right.
Yeah. Hopefully the England manager makes it work this summer, if not later on, because I think this might be this manager's last chance at doing so. His job is safe anyway for the time being, Gareth Southgate, because I think one of the best managers of the world has been recently appointed elsewhere. I think his competitors have been snapped up. We go to the UAE. Al Kabila, a club I don't know.
I don't think anyone knows them yet.
We're getting there, yeah.
Yeah.
So they've got American investors or founders, co-founders, who are very front-facing, running things on social media, saying stuff like, we're building a pro football club in 365 days. and they're doing this very, like, the sort of TikToks that you scroll past a bit quickly because you're like, oh, this feels like a trap. This feels like a pyramid scheme in waiting. Like, let me show you how I became a trillionaire in 25 days. They're doing that about a football club. We're building a pro football club in 365 days, and we're just about to announce our new manager. And then this video, the hype is so mad. They're bigging each other up. They're like, man, this guy's a Premier League star. Man, I can't believe we've got him. And to be fair, had led a club to consecutive promotions. The car opens, the limousine that arrives in this video, which is shot in the middle of the desert for reasons. Who steps out of that car, suited and booted, to be the new manager of Al Kabila? Stephen Taylor, former Newcastle defender, England under 21, he of the shot by a sniper at St James's Park fame in the here and Dyer Boya fight.
Yeah.
Has been busy managing in Dubai, winning consecutive promotions in the lower tier. And it's got him a big job with this new club who are trying to make waves. he seems to ride out the American awkwardness of the video quite well.
I think very well.
But it is mad. And it is just a funny, it's not a jump scare. It is a funny reveal when you see who it is.
Do you know what it is? Do you know what I'll give him credit for? Yeah. I think the reality is, if you're already in the UAE, you're accustomed to a sort of form over function lifestyle. Everything looks really pretty. Everything is gilded edge, right? And that's no disrespect. I mean, I respect the loads of stuff in the UAE is just built to be extravagant. You're already in that lifestyle. And I think that is actually quite a good foil, quite a good match for, you know, the uber capitalist American state. Yeah. So he could probably make that work. And, you know, like you said, he's been there for a while. He's winning consecutive promotions, so it's not even like, you know, like obviously last year, you know, all the Saudi Arabian teams tried to get managers who were just pros off the name. This is actually somebody who's been here for a sec and has kind of low key got it out of the mud in like regards to these leagues. Like you have to give him a bit of credit. I don't know how long the UAE league's been going about, but he is the first person to ever get any team there back-to-back promotions. So they're probably looking at him like, oh, this is a prem star who's actually very good at management. Like, he's not just a name. Like, he's actually probably built for this.
Yeah. Nice to hear from him. I think it's one of those, the ownership is my concern, because I think they're going to be really, if this is how they set the mark out, I imagine what follows in terms of how they chronicle him, how they make him kind of stand up under the spotlight for things that just go beyond what a manager should do traditionally. I think that could result in all kinds of viral moments that he'll be wincing at. We'll try to keep an eye on that one, but forgive us if we're not tracking the UAE lower leagues.
Al Kabila already has 65,000 followers and it doesn't even exist yet. That is so interesting.
But yeah, good luck, Stephen Taylor. But we're going to leave it there. It turns out we said it would be a quick update, and it has been, because we've got a lot of time set aside for this week's guest interview, who warrants the time. Bless him. Very patient. We had a nightmare setting up with him, and it was like half an hour, 40 minutes before we actually were able to start the interview. And he was just in his office, like, doing sound checks. Yeah. It was
so patient. God bless him.
This is someone that perfectly encapsulates international clearance for me, which is why we had to get him on. Gets his badges in his 20s and licenses, has some good jobs, but just takes the maddest job as far away as possible as well, and not just has a story to tell about it, but also leaves a crazy like legacy and impact on that part of the world where he briefly worked. And
incredible story.
Yeah, that place, by the way, is the Cook Islands, one of the smaller FIFA nations. And he coached them when he was like 28, 29. This is like amazing, amazing story, and warrants the rest of your time on this episode.
Low key, we should have put this out. We should have just got the rights to film.
Hey, there's still time. There's still time. But yeah, without further ado, this is Scully and I talking with Drew. International clearance. It's our first Welsh guest, Scully. Finally, this is very overdue.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we've completed the set now. We've been builders, Britons, overseas and abroad, but a Welsh guest was the last to tick off. And we're delighted to be joined by Drew Sherman, Senior Domestic Academies Manager of the Football Association of Wales. Drew, welcome to the show. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really exotic, aren't we, as Welsh people? So, yeah, nice little fact there.
Well, hey, I mean, as exotic goes, that some of the jobs that you've done, which is just a great interest to us, because it is very much that. You got your pro and A licenses by 21 and youth development coach at Southampton, academy manager at Aldershot. Can you describe to me first this Everton job, Asia Pacific Football Academy coordinator based in New Zealand? What did that entail at the time and how old were you at that point?
Yeah, that was my first job in football. It was an entity connected to the international department, Everton. So effectively, like a third-party organisation that were delivering a programme for elite players in Asia-Pacific, specifically New Zealanders. that established a residential academy based in Christchurch in New Zealand, and brought together basically the most talented New Zealand eligible players to be part of that residential academy. And most of them have progressed to have decent careers in Venice and play for the national team. So yeah, it was quite successful, and the Everton link was around sort of support and pathways and leverage off the expertise there. Yeah, it was an interesting one, interesting experience. I guess the start of my rapid collection of air miles. That probably was. Yeah. So I certainly enjoyed that role.
Yeah, that part of the world, is there a broader connection there family wise? I know your father's had some jobs that way. Is that kind of any relation to that?
That's right. Yeah. So my father was the technical director of Football Association of Wales until 2006, and then he went to be a technical director in New Zealand. And he's been in that part of the world ever since. Really, his background's in coach education. And I guess that almost shaped my destiny, I suppose. Like his background in coach education, all of our round of dinner conversations were about coaching. And so it became like a little bit of a family culture that I would follow in his footsteps into this field here.
His greatest graduate. That was the division.
Debatable. I'd suggest that's debatable, yeah.
So you're youth development coach at Southampton. The Cook Islands opportunity, does that pop out of nowhere? What's the origins of that? How does that
Yeah.
all come around?
Almost, honestly, almost. So I guess linked to what I've just said there, my father left Wales to go to New Zealand when I was under 18. So I have New Zealand permanent residency off the back of his move, although I'd never been. So because of that, the Cook Island is similar to, I suppose, the United Kingdom, in that as a Welshman, you get a British passport. As a Cook Islander, you have a New Zealand passport. So I could work in the Cook Islands without visa implications because I was eligible to work in New Zealand as a resident. And I was driving. I lived in West London when I was working at Southampton. So long drives down for daily trading 6 days a week. And one evening I was coming back and I had just a random country number on my phone.
A plus
And
number, you don't know what dialing code that is.
thought I'd won some sort of lottery or something. Usually I wouldn't have answered it, but I thought, I'll humour myself. I got an hour and 45 minutes in the car. So I picked it up, and this guy introduced himself as the president of the Cook Islands Football Association. I've never heard of the Cook Islands, but as he started to speak, he sort of piqued my interest, talking about we're looking for a national team coach, need someone who's eligible to reside in New Zealand. Your name has popped up through Oceania Football Confederation. Would you be interested in coming and coaching our national team? So yeah, well, possibly. I'll speak to my fiance at the time. Yeah, maybe. Like, can I phone you back in a couple of days? And he said, well, I need a quick answer because the tournament's in 3 months. So it was by the time I drove up the M3 and Googled Cook Islands, I mean, if you do that on your phone yourself, like, you take the job, right? So it was a pretty quick conversation. I showed my fiance a few pictures of the beaches, and next thing you know, we're on a plane.
Yeah, I'm sure the beaches sold it for her. Were you a little bit worried? Because I'm not gonna lie, I think I'd be a bit worried if somebody called me and offered me a job and said, but also you need to decide by the end of this phone call. Like, there's something about
Yeah,
that. Like,
it was probably a little bit of a writing on the wall moment of the way in which I suppose some of those small member associations operate.
right.
Yeah, it is very ad hoc, to put it kindly. But yeah, listen, it was an incredible experience, and it wasn't quite end of the phone call. I think I maybe had 24 hours to phone it back. But yeah, it was definitely had to be a quick decision. So it was interesting. I think I was probably ready at that time, having worked in youth development for a bare number of years, to maybe challenge myself and try something a bit different. I don't think I was really aware of the scope of the challenge. It was only after I'd taken the job I realized that they were the lowest ranked country in FIFA rankings at that time, that they'd never won a game, and all of the other implications. And even when I arrived, I can remember landing in Rarotonga at the airport, and the same guy, the president, picked me up and said, we got training tonight. Okay, great. And I get to train, I got three players. Like, you do know this is 11 a side, right? We need at least 11 to play the game in 12 weeks. So yeah, it was an eye-opening experience, certainly. But yeah, probably one of the best experiences I've had professionally.
What was the difference in the brief that was perhaps pitched to you as technical director and manager, and then actually what the actual job was looking like it was going to have to be?
No, do you know what? They were really transparent with what the scope of it was. Like you said, it was also not just looking after the national team. It was also the technical director piece, which was about helping to guide on what some sort of sustainability or like driving interest in discovering football. I think my biggest challenge was understanding culture and adapting to environment. And it took me a little while with that. Like, it's a really unique, but a really strong and connected culture. And it's very tribal, in the sense that like the villages, the people that play sport play for their village, and they play multi-sport because there's not many of them. There's 10,000 people on the island, right? 12,000 people in the entire country, which is actually, it covers ocean the size of Western Europe. So the distance between the furthest islands, you're looking at Lisbon to Moscow. Wow. In terms of the geographic size of the islands, how spread out they are. But only 12,000 people live there. So yeah, it was really interesting to try and unpick, I guess, the culture of when I arrived and just to get people more interested in football. Part of my remit at Southampton was getting more kids out of London down because of where I was based, and making sure they were tapping into the talent that was on the doorstep down there. And so, you know, I'd be dealing with a lot of kids who were inner city London kids, culturally hissing your teeth or smacking your lips is a bit of a sign of disrespect, like, as you know, in the UK.
Yeah.
There in the Cook Islands, it's a sign of acknowledgement. So to do exactly the same facial expression or mannerism is like, I accept what you're saying. Very different. So I arrived, and for 3 weeks, I'm taking training sessions, and I'm getting these players kissing their teeth at me. I'm going, what is going on here? I can't believe it. But eventually I realized that actually, no, that's how they say yes, basically. You know? And oh, I get it. I understand. So yeah, it just adapting to environment, which I think, it's probably the start point with any job where you put yourself in a different context. You know, if you travel overseas, it's adapting to culture and environment and spending time to understand that rather than coming in as some sort of guru, you know, with all the answers, which will just upset people.
Yeah. You've mentioned a sparse population, a small population, and this is a small FIFA member, right? So the first thing I guess you would say is, find diaspora in the larger parts of Oceania and stuff. But logistically, financially, how realistic was that? And you've already mentioned that they are citizens or can get citizenship from New Zealand. So how difficult was it getting anybody to not declare for New Zealand and try with you guys?
Yeah, tough. Really tough. So that was that had to be plan A, right? In 3 months, how can we find Cook Island eligible players based predominantly in New Zealand, where they can travel freely between, but also Australia. So that was definitely the remit. And we used all sorts of tactics. We spoke to Sports Interactive about accessing a database for Football Manager.
Wow.
We had people who had emigrated 20, 30 years ago, almost doing ad hoc scouting for us. And it wasn't necessarily scouting. It was just, do they play football?
Right.
And are they eligible? And if they are, we'll have a training camp and let's have a look. So we all managed to get a training camp in Auckland where we had about, I'd say about 35 players together. And I'd become aware of Max Crocombe, who's at Burton Albion now. But at the time, he was playing in the non-league. Max is Cook Island eligible, yeah. But a Kiwi. And really, strangely enough, our paths crossed again when I was at Melbourne Victory and he was a player for us there. But I was hoping, we'll get Max involved and make a massive difference because he's playing non-league football in the UK. I think at Salford it was at the time. Maybe not on the radar and the New Zealand national team. Like within 24 hours of reaching out, he's called into the next New Zealand squad. Wow. So that was a real problem. And it actually meant we were all in. We had everything on red there. And it didn't pan out for us. So we actually went to the qualifiers with no goalkeeper.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had a central defender in goal. It worked in the office with me. And we spent a little bit of time talking about goalkeeper because he was good with his feet and he was a big lad. And as I said, they're multi-sports. They didn't play a lot of multi-sports. He'd been involved in those, so decent hand-eye coordination. But yeah, I thought, you know, worst case scenario, just sweep up behind the defence. But yeah, we had no goalkeeper when it came to playing our games, which was an interesting challenge in itself.
Neuer-like. Sweep keeper, yeah. Good with his feet. Yeah, he'll be all right.
He'd be delighted to hear that comparison, I'm sure. Yeah. But no, he was, like I said, he worked actually in the association. So we spent a little bit extra time, and I'm no goalkeeper coach by any stretch, but just trying to get him sort of up to speed, really. In fairness to him, he did fantastically well in those games for us as well. And I think that sort of became his position then for the next couple of campaigns since.
Wow. Given the base, the quality of the player base generally, did that actually give you more room for improvement in terms of coaching, depending on how much time you had with them? Or did you find that the focus was tactical discipline with these guys would make a huge difference over skill work, ball work?
Yeah, I mean, listen, we got some players who were playing at decent levels within like New Zealand and Australia that were eligible. But the one thing that I think became like the major advantage was just how open-minded they were, how strong they were, and like connected to each other because of their lineage, you know, because of their connection to the Cook Islands, like, and their pride in that. And like, oh, there's a chance to actually create a bit of a story. Yeah, we were the worst, you know, worst team in FIFA rankings, but you know what? We might actually win a game. We might qualify for those Oceania Nations. Like, there's an opportunity. So they were really positive, and they took on board like quite simple information. Like, you know, ultimately, you haven't got to be a great football player to be willing to run, you know, and to talk to each other. You know, that doesn't come down to your technical skills. So it was the other facets where actually their strength was their togetherness, their strength was their willingness. And that became like the core part of their DNA that was sort of why they ended up having an element of success.
How do you go about implementing a culture in a shorter amount of time? Because like I said, you have to learn their culture and be able to speak to them, but they also need to learn a little bit about football and the ideals that you have for them.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't me imposing any sort of culture. It was me tapping into what was already there, you know, and that was key. Like it was me learning and actually like trying to get them to teach me became like a really powerful method for them to like consolidate themselves. You know, by them teaching it, it made them reflect on it. So I'm there being the outsider. They're not going in, teach me the anthem, teach me the national anthem. Explain to me like why are we praying before and after every session, and like what's the deeply religious connection? How do we make that a strength when it comes to how we perform? Like, so I was using it as a way where they were sort of teaching me. I had a local assistant who again was, you know, been a former player involved, and they're quite connected because it is such a small place with such a small population. A lot of them are related, you know, if not first cousins, second cousins. So it's almost like if you went and played five a side down the goal centre with your family, like there's a connection, isn't there? Right. And it was almost like that. That's sort of how it was. It was like they were playing with their mates. They were just doing it for their country. And I was helping them to build that, I suppose. But so it wasn't necessarily me imposing it. It was me just bringing to light what was already there and like giving them a sense of pride about it, you know, and more that they could own it and it was their story. And, you know, people back home would be cheering them on when we were in Tonga or in Samoa.
The fixtures that you were kind of readying yourselves for 3 months later, bear in mind this is 2015, Scully. This is probably the first stage anywhere in the world for the 2018 World Cup. And it can all be over in a week. This is four sides in a group stage. The winner goes through to not just the OFC Nations Cup, but actually the next round of qualifying. It doubles up as World Cup qualifying in that region. So the group is yourselves, Tonga, who are hosting, American Samoa and Samoa, and you play each other all over about a week in August, the end of August, start September 2015 in the same area in Tonga with the winner going through. I mean, seeing some of those names, American Samoa, particularly now, we've just had that Taika Waititi film, next goal wins.
But the documentary that it's inspired it and the story is incredible. Would recommend it to any listeners. Is that a close enough story, proximity-wise, for the Cook Islands to be aware of it and to be inspired by?
Yeah. Do you know what? That's at the time, I know it's just come out as a film with Michael Fassbender now, isn't it? But originally there was a film or a documentary, and it had only been released like maybe 2 years prior.
Right.
And what had happened? They'd had a massive drive of like, they just unearthed American-based American Samoans.
Right.
Off the back of the documentary. They were training in America, in San Francisco. Who were based in American Samoa. You know, what you have to understand is athletically, these Pacific Islanders are incredible. You know, American Samoas have 40% more chance of playing in the NFL than any other race, basically. Wow. You know, so they're just incredible athletes. So it was certainly an interesting challenge. American Samoa were really strong. They were a bit of a surprise, if I'm honest. But yeah, it was. We were probably entering that, I would say, as well, the worst team, certainly the least favored. Tonga being host, as you said, Samoa, much bigger population, and American Samoa had just had this massive like media presence and seems to thrive in it through the Next Goal Wins film. But our awareness of that film definitely inspired the group to be like, listen, this could be you.
Yeah.
And this could be you writing your story on a step to Russia in 2018. I think at one point, like you said, it's the first qualifiers. Our midfielder was the FIFA World Cup highest goal scorer after two games. So, like, you know, it's on the FIFA rankings. I think that we moved up 59 places in the FIFA rankings that year, 2015. So although they didn't quite achieve what they set out, missed out on goal difference, they still were the highest moving country in the FIFA rankings in that year. So, like, there's, again, great sense of pride in glamorously failing, I suppose.
That's incredible. That's incredible. You came close. I'm going to let Joe read out the results. You just mentioned there you lost out by a goal difference. It was incredible.
Well, yeah, but you start so well. You beat Tonga 3-0, and you mentioned in midfield, the Taylor Sagabi hat-trick, and then he scores again in your second game where you beat Samoa, the much bigger population, 1-0. At that point, is it confidence? Is it nerves at this point? To be win two games in a four-team group, that's a normally encouraging sign.
Oh, it's normally a shoo-in, isn't it?
Yeah.
6 points in a four-team group. You're there or thereabouts. I think they just got like a bit of squeaky bum time, really. Like, they're a bit nervous.
New feeling for them.
The guy who I mentioned. Yeah. It's such an alien position to be in. They'd just been used to getting battered. And now all of a sudden they found that, oh, we've won two games. We might actually have a chance here of going to the next round. The president had made some massive promises as well, thinking there's no chance this is going to happen. Like flying families to the next group, bonuses, all sorts of stuff. And like, these guys are watermelon farmers and stuff, like the local guys, you know what I mean, or builders. So they're like getting a bit ahead of themselves. We actually conceded the two goals we lost to American Samoa and knocked us out. We're both set pieces that go straight through our goalkeeper / central defender's hands. And so, like, what can you do? Yeah, it is what it is, right? Two free kicks, and that is what it is. But you can't blame him. He's doing something that way out of his comfort zone. He's unbelievable for the first couple of games. And then, unfortunately, that's football, isn't it? You know, it's playing so for two games out of three isn't enough.
So unfortunate. If you just, and no disrespect to your Neuer-like sweeper keeper, who was also working with the association. But if you just had a keeper, you really might have done it.
Yeah.
Oh, so close.
Yeah. But like you say, I mean, that's the first step. Those are the qualifiers to get to the Oceania nations. And then, you know, you come up against some of the bigger countries, I suppose, in your Fijis, your New Zealands, your Solomon Islands that are probably, you know, although in the global sense, not strong teams, but certainly way ahead of those four. But yeah, like I said, really fond memories of the experience in general. I really enjoyed my time there. It taught me a lot about not just like learning about the culture there, but learning about myself as well, you know?
Yeah, because this is all happening when you're sort of 28. It's like a really life-forming kind of experience at that age, certainly. And so the World Cup qualification ends there after this kind of roller coaster of a week. Your remaining kind of year, 18 months, not quite sure the full length of your time remaining there, you're focused, I guess, on the technical director role. And What kind of legacy did that campaign have, or did it positively affect what the work you're able to do for the remainder of your time there?
Yeah, I think so. I think what it allowed us to get buy-in when we sort of, we created, say, National Academy, but when you got so small numbers, it was just like weekly training or bi-weekly training contacts with under 17s, boys, girls, 15s, boys, girls. And they actually didn't have a league that went younger than under 15s at that time. So we went into the primary schools and established like junior leagues, under 11s, under 9s, that then sort of fed through. So what we were able to do was to get kids interacting with the sport younger and playing. And that's something I think it became really successful during the 18 months after that I was still there. I'm pretty sure they still run it now, you know, and they've got really high uptake with these junior festivals, with the schools that are connected to the club. So they're having more domestic based, a deeper talent pool, really, of domestic based players, just because more kids are engaging. So yeah, I think it was a positive, and I think like it probably wouldn't have been as positive had we not had the impact with the national team.
Do you kind of keep an eye on it now? Do you like look back and think, I wonder how they're doing? I wonder if there is, like you're saying, like if the infrastructure is growing, if they're going to continue to believe?
Yeah, I get the odd message from like some of the players when the games sort of swing around. Some of them that are still involved will drop me a message, or like I still get updates through social media, like now and then pop up on like, oh, this is what's happening with CIFA, the federation, and like the kids playing football. And they've had a couple of Brits since myself as well, who I think have done a really good job to like build on stuff. There was a Scottish guy who went in after me, and then Jess Ibram, who's been in a few of the areas in that area, I think is back there now, involved in the national team. So like, I think what they did do is they probably looked at it and went, I think I was at that point, the first person who was maybe a non-New Zealander, although I had the passport, that had gone in there. And I think they probably looked and gone, oh, actually, we can continue on a bit of work here, a bit further afield. And they went for a few Europeans that genuinely were non-New Zealanders. You know?
Incredible. So coming out of there, I guess it really does that kind of success, especially on the technical director's level and that infrastructure level, as well as what they achieved on the pitch. That must give you a lot of stock, particularly in that region, for further work. And then that kind of, I suppose, leads you to Brisbane Roar, where you kind of a technical director there for 2-3 years, and then also head up the youth team as a coach there as well. Cook Islands, that has to be the kind of brief that they've seen you on, right? Or is it also the work you've done prior?
If I'm honest, I don't think so. I think like even in Australia, Oceania is seen as how it's seen here, right?
Right.
You know, so to say, oh, Brisbane Roar have noticed that is almost as though saying like Man United were picking up the phone. Like it's a similar context. So what I did do whilst I was in the Cook Islands is I did my AFC Pro license as well in Australia.
Right.
So I used the time I was there to get qualified to work in Asia, thinking that, listen, Cook Islands, maybe something pops up, and it's my wife's half Malaysian. So I thought, oh, maybe something pops up in Malaysia or something like that. And
right.
Yeah, we've got the appropriate qualifications. It just opens doors. When I did my pro license, I was with two brothers, Aloisi brothers, who are really well known in Australia. John Aloisi played in the UK.
Played for Portsmouth, didn't he?
Portsmouth, Coventry, yeah. So, and a top coach as well. And he was head coach at Brisbane Roar. I did my pro license with those two. And the director of football at the time was Craig Moore, Rangers Craig Moore.
Yeah, played for Palace and Rangers, yeah.
And, yeah, Newcastle. Yeah. So again, they had like a really good staff group, I suppose, at the club, who were really well respected in Australian football because of their playing backgrounds.
Hmm.
And they effectively brought me in. I realised they had a little bit of a gap on the technical side to look after their youth programmes, which were being launched. Would I come in and do that off the back of being on the course with them? Which was great. And, you know, to work with people like that as well, with the profile they had, certainly in the country, was incredible. Like, really, really enjoyed my time in Brisbane. And again, felt like maybe more than most places that I've worked, was able to have a really quick impact in getting something quite good in place, you know.
How did it feel? How satisfying was it to, when you're working with the youth side and obviously do very well with them, which we'll get to, but being back in the flow of like taking regular training, I suppose, and having really frequent sessions with a side. That must have been even as fun as the enjoyable and enlightening as the Cook Islands experience was. There's nothing more enriching than being out on the grass every day, right?
100%, yeah. It was a big reason for going there at the time when we were thinking about, listen, we've had our sabbatical, we'll go back, you know, I'll go back into something like my job at Southampton, whatever it may be. So we were in two minds as a family, really, at that point about, so we come back to the UK or what happens? But one of the big things, and I suppose it's been a bit of an evolution here recently, is my role was almost like that hybrid role where I was working with the first team on a daily basis, like as an third assistant in terms of prepping the professional team. And then because of the age of the youth team players, the training would very often be after, you know, so you do a first team session, you go work with the youth team players and you'd be across both. And it helps to like smooth the pathway of transition players between the two. So yeah, it was great because I'd gone from being on the pitch like at Southampton every day, 9 hours a day, to not really being on the pitch in the Cook Islands, just at the camps, and then back onto it again, you know, but except at a level where you're working with, you know, professional players who played at a top level. You know, that's what the A-League is. So, yeah, it was great. It was great for me. It was great to be around the level of coaches that I worked with as well, and have, I guess, the autonomy across the youth department being in its infancy.
And you win the National Youth League that year, something to hang your hat on, as always. You then, sort of 2019-20 season, go into Melbourne Victory. Could you describe the position, the difference between, say, a technical director and a general manager?
Yeah, so the technical director is more on field. I suppose here, the most, if you work in like football, it's, I guess it's more like the academy director or your head of coaching type of role at Brisbane Roar. So not just focused on the youth team, though, but working then across first team, as I just said. So it was really hands-on, on-field coaching, and then being responsible for like methodology and what that looks like, which is just one component, I guess, of the sporting director role, director of football, general manager role. When I went to Melbourne Victory, I originally went in the technical director role. So I went there. They'd had, I would say, a youth team program that had been in a little bit of a slump, and their reputation, certainly in Australia, is we're the best club, we're the biggest club, we win.
Right.
So who won the youth league? Right, let's go get it. And that's how I ended up at Melbourne Victory. So I went in originally in that role. I've developed a really good relationship with the CEO there, and I think he identified that there were some gaps in terms of where they were short. They'd had a load of continuity. They'd had Kevin Muscat, infamous over here, but famous in Australia. Kevin Muscat, honestly, chalk and cheese, the loveliest man you ever meet. Right. But on pitch reputation speaks for himself. But he was there when I first came in. And after about 6 months, he departed. They'd had a real continuity in their coaching.
Yeah,
they'd had Ange Postecoglou. Kevin Muscat stepped into his shoes. And they'd had continuity for a number of years, and now they were left with this gap because they didn't have someone who could pick up the reins.
Right.
And they bought in a German manager, and at the point they very early realised, well, maybe things aren't working particularly well here, and then asked really me as a technical person to be more involved in not just youth team transition into first team. I was already overseeing the women's department as well, by the way. My remit was across general manager of youth and academy. And then they asked me to sort of swallow the whole lot and have greater influence over it. Although I didn't have direct accountability or management of the first team at that time, that came eventually with streamlining the business during COVID.
Yeah. Well, what impact does COVID then have on that role at that time?
Well, yeah, I think that, like, I'm not sure I answered your last question there. When you talk about the difference, like the difference probably was around the technical director role that I previously had, being really on field, hands-on with the coaching, working with your coach, delivering stuff. The general manager was more around like safeguarding the pillars of what is football. And at that club, it was the women's department, the elite women's department, the elite men's department, the youth academy, and then community engagement. So being across all of it and effectively managing the people that look after each of those. Originally, it didn't include that men's pillar, that was led by Kevin Muscat. It was the three others, but it sort of swallowed that during COVID. The impact of COVID was incredible, really challenging. Obviously, Melbourne, where Melbourne Victory are based, was the most locked down city in the world during COVID, I think outside of Buenos Aires. So in that last year that I was at the club, it was something like 280 days out of 360 where you couldn't leave your house. So it was a really militant approach to it, which in hindsight is mental, right? But at the time, you know, was really strictly enforced. So it had a massive impact on us, what we were able to deliver. We were at that point competing in the Asian Champions League.
Yeah,
I was expecting the birth of my daughter, my second child at that time. I've really luckily decided it wouldn't be the best to travel to Qatar for Asian Champions League, which was going to be hosted like the World Cup was, right, in one venue because of COVID, right, with all the teams flying in, just in case. The team ended up stuck there for, I think it was 2 months.
Wow.
Stuck in Qatar. We were trying to sign players and build a squad, but no one could fly to Australia. Not even Australians could return home. So we had to fly any new signings into Qatar where the team was stuck and then leverage them off paying back the government, helping them get back into the country.
Crikey.
But they missed all of pre-season. Couldn't train. It stuck in Qatar. And they arrived, I think, back maybe 5 days. They managed to fly direct into Sydney, like 3 days before they were due to start the league.
Oh, my gosh.
So when we had a slow start to the year during COVID, well, they hadn't trained. They hadn't even met each other. And plus, like the league at that time was, well, it still is, it's a salary cap league.
Yeah.
Where in the year before, we'd had a challenging year and we were due for a big squad rebuild, all of which was planned upon a salary cap amount, which then during COVID was slashed. You know, so your budget's cut by 40% of what you can spend, knowing that, hang on, we've retained players on this amount, thinking that that's this percentage of our allocation. Well, now the percentage is double and we've got this much left to spend on a massive rebuild. Right? So, yeah, the impact of it across all facets of the club were just disastrous. You know, academy shut down training, women's department became really, really challenging to sustain. And then obviously trying to onboard coaches and deliver stuff in terms of a program that needs a significant rebuild just became, well, almost impossible. Right? And for a club that have a reputation and were used to winning, a slow rebuild just wasn't an option.
Yeah, it sounds very stressful. I do wonder, because you go back to your ownership days and then Southampton, and you're talking about you had a fiance who became your wife. Did you feel like you had to do the right thing by her by times you were talking about maybe going to Asia at some point because she was half Malaysian? Like, and even having children out during your journey, like, how did all of these things weigh on you as a man?
100%. 100%. And you know what? Like, she, throughout it, she's been unbelievable. You know, like, pack your bags, move the house, we're off. Like, we'd bought a house in Brisbane, really well settled, just had a baby. Right, we're going to Melbourne. Like, we've got to be in Melbourne in 8 weeks. We've got to sell a house. Like it's just unbelievable dealing with the nature, the demands that the roles in football place on you personally. Like, and I think anybody who has a successful career in football and a successful marriage, like, is incredibly fortunate for the person that they've married, that's how understanding and supportive they are.
Yeah.
You know, the two have to be hand in hand because, you know, certainly as a coach, you can't offset it with, well, sorry, I'm earning 120 grand a week. So you just go shopping and you drive a Bentley and you'd be all right. It's not quite the same. Yeah. So it's a very different approach. But yeah, like, I mean, she's been incredible for me throughout all of the stages of my career. And I think that was a major factor really in like moving home and coming back here after nearly 8 years of being like away. Feeling far from family, feeling far from friends, feeling far from like what's familiar during COVID, it was time for me to say, you know what, like, let's, you need a bit of say in this. Like, I can't just continue to ask you to up and leave every 2-3 years because we're just following an opportunity. Like, we got to do what's best for what's best for us, you know, and we need to see what's best for our kids now. You know? So, yeah, and I think I'd be very surprised. I know it's a big thing at the moment around, like, coach well-being and balance of family life is becoming more prevalent, certainly in our industry. But I believe that it's something that almost all, if not every coach or and player experiences these challenges. You know?
Wow. Your current role then within the Football Association of Wales, you know, an FA that has got quite a renowned reputation in where people get their coaching badges, but also just their work in youth football as well. What's your kind of work and ambitions and targets from your role?
Yeah, so I'm immersed in the national youth teams. So I work really closely, sort of head coach the under 15s, which is our first age group where we bring them together. Right. Which is great, you know. Funnily enough, like, it was the age group my father had before he left the UK in, you know, 2006. So quite nice. There's a little bit of family legacy with that group. So I look after them through a 2-year cycle, 15-16s, which is fantastic because you're involved with top players and our talents, and you get to like build a little bit of connection to Wales because a lot of our players here are not necessarily born in Wales. They're in the English system, and actually most of our players, almost, it was 100%, like 100% of our players were in the English system, including Cardiff, Swansea, Newport, by the age of 12. So they're all playing in the English academy structure, whether they're Welsh or not. And that's a big part of my role, is to how do we raise standards of our domestic club programs,
right,
so that kids haven't got to travel over the border so far just to access these programs. Now, we're not naive enough in Wales to think that, listen, if you live in Flint or Connors Quay and Manchester United want to sign, that you're not going to go over the border. Of course you are. But of course, yeah. You know, Man United spend 6 times what our national budget is for domestic academies, just on their program, right? So why would you not go to those type of clubs? It's going to be much better for you. But if you live in Aberystwyth, well, then what? Or you live in Bangor, well, then what? Where can you go? So how do we make sure there's environments that are quality assured across Wales that can offer a level of program linked to our domestic league that will almost help us to unearth talent, connect football, and have a much more efficient pathway of progressing them into our national teams? So I look after that, which underpins then the players entering our pathways at 15s and 16s. It's an interesting job. It's a varied job. I think it's fair to say that I was intentionally asked to come back into this role because I'd been away for so long, because it was a job that needed change and disruption, which has made it a challenge in the last couple of years. But I think we're moving in the right space. And, you know, like you said, we've had a really good track record in the last decade of Welsh teams and Welsh talent, like the depth of Welsh talent improving, Welsh teams having success on a global stage. And that's come in with our female provision too. You know, we're at the start of that tidal wave with those players as well. We just got to make sure it continues. And the way to do that is that we've got really efficient infrastructure within the country in place instead of just being completely reliant upon the English system to serve us. So yeah, it's a job around creating a long-term sense of redundancy and control really over our destiny of player development.
Wow. There's some key words there, Scully, in that answer that I did. Interesting, disrupting, sums up not just that role, but I guess your coaching and football career so far. And that's why we wanted to talk to you, Drew. It's been really fascinating to learn more about those experiences. So thank you so much. And I look forward to seeing the rest of your career play out. We'll be keeping an eye. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Drew for sharing so much of his journey. It was such an interesting chat. I feel like we've had two absolute bangers of some guests. We took a while, yeah. I know you guys have been a little bit impatient, but we had some great ones in it. So, like, I'm just excited to see what he does with the rest of his career and how he progresses.
Well, he seems to be certainly part of the senior staff in the FA that are responsible for improving it and leading that next generation in the right direction. So I guess it's more about Welsh Football Watch rather than whether he takes up any other kind of management or coaching jobs.
Either way, I'm invested.
But certainly the most we've kind of had insight as well on jobs like the technical directors and general managers and what they actually entail. it was cool to just get some more insight on that and his experiences in that. But yeah, he seems pretty happy where he is right now. They'll never take away his Cook Islands adventure, whatever happens.
Like I said, the film is coming soon. If you know of any more incredible stories like that, you know how to reach us. intlclearance@gmail.com. intlclearance, I'm going to say that one more time, on the Instagram, on the TikTok, on the X. I nearly said Twitter. It's not Twitter anymore, it's X.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks very much again to Drew. Thanks for joining us on the show. I've been Joe Walker.
I've been Scully.
And that's been International Clearance. See you next week.